story of the Magi begins long before Bethlehem. The story of the Magi begins in the far reaches of the stars and begins 800 years before the birth of Jesus. It all began with the great king Nabonassar, ruler of the Babylonian Empire. To Nebuchadnezzar goes the glory and the honor of first having begun the work, the great work of centuries, the work of the stone clay tablets. The tablets recording the precise movement of the stars. King Nebuchadnezzar began a project that would last centuries. Every single night, the Babylonian court astronomers, they would be sent out and they would observe the stars. They would chart their movements in the sky and note their appearances every single night for 800 years. These experts in the night sky would watch for where the stars arose, noting their position in the sky, their position relative to the other stars, making note of any changes that might occur, that occurred over months or years or generations. They recorded their findings, but they recorded them by carving them into clay tablets so that there was no chance that they would rot away. See, papyrus or vellum, these things over a few centuries might simply disintegrate so their records would be lost. They ensured that they would last forever by carving them in minute detail into clay tablets. Now, this task of recording all of this information, it stretched past, it strained beyond the capabilities of their written language. And so they developed a new one. In order to meet the challenges of taking these records more efficiently, these astronomers, they developed an ornate and complex code. It was the mathematical wing of the cuneiform script. It was a code as daunting as it was brilliant. Each tablet of records, maybe this size, would be covered in thousands upon thousands of tiny triangles, arranged in such a way that to the trained eye, you could see not a chaos of shapes, but rather an accurate star chart that spanned years just on a single tablet. In just a day's work, just a day's worth of calculation, one of these Babylonian astronomers could sit down and look back over 10 lifetimes of observation. 10 lifetimes of stars rising and setting. These Babylonian astronomers, they alone among the ancients, they alone could watch time as it truly moves beyond a single lifetime, beyond 10 lifetimes, over 8 centuries they watched time rise and fall, and in all of that time, of all the information they amassed, they were most hungry of all to understand the movement of just a few stars, just a handful of all of the lights of heaven. You see, over 8 centuries they had noticed that the stars did not change their position relative to one another. Not for one day, not for one minute of the day did the stars change their position relative to one another, always true to their course. Exceptions? 4, 5. Except for 5. They would occasionally race ahead of the rest of the stars, or sometimes simply stop dead still while the rest of the heavens spun around them. Sometimes they would move against the flow of the entire heavens. Why did these, of all the lights of heaven, move differently? And what did their movements mean? This was the question they most wanted to understand. In later centuries, these lights, they would be given names like Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, Mercury, Mars, names of gods. But to the Babylonian astronomers, they were named Marduk, Ishtar, Nineb, Nebu, Nergal. They desired most of all to understand and discover the logic, the laws that stood behind why these lights moved in this way. What was behind the motion of these special stars? They looked for patterns, any patterns that they could find in their 800 years of records, and they found them. They found patterns. But the patterns were too complex to analyze with the mathematics that they had at their disposal, simple arithmetic that had been developed to keep track of the sales of wheat. They needed something far more elegant. And so they developed new speculative mathematics, elegant, beautiful geometries that charted space that existed only in their mind, that referred to nothing on the earth itself. Curvilinear geometries. They could accurately depict the movement of Jupiter relative to the Earth, charting a curvilinear line through abstract geometric space. With advanced mathematics and with meticulous records, they could describe not only where all of these stars had been over the course of many centuries, but they could, with precision, predict where those stars were going to appear and what their movements were going to be. Mark that. These Babylonian astronomers, they could predict future events. They could predict future events years and years in advance. But what drove them? What drove this many century long quest? Well, to them, these stars were not things like rocks. They weren't things at all. They were beings. They were beings like the angels. They were, like the angels, utterly obedient to the divine will. The movements of the stars reflected absolutely the will of the God, the way that an image in a mirror absolutely reflects the movements of the one cast in it. One cannot move without the other. They are one and the same. You see, the movements of the stars, they showed the actions of the gods. If the gods were deciding to essentially leave the events of Earth to move on their placid way all on their own, then the stars, too, would move placidly on their way. But if the gods were orchestrating great and mighty changes on the Earth, then these would be accompanied by great and mighty changes in the stars. This idea that there is an intimate connection between events on the earth and events in the stars, this idea, it still exists in our language even. This idea still survives. You can see it in the word catastrophe, literally an upheaval in the stars, catastrophe. These Babylonian astronomers, they understood, they could predict what would happen in the heavens. If the events of the world would be reflected in the stars, then these were people who had a roadmap to events unfolding in the world. Here were people who had a window into the plans of the gods. These Babylonian astronomers, they were known throughout the ancient world. They were known as the world's foremost experts in the stars. They were called Chaldeans. In fact, for a long time, there was no word for astronomer other than Chaldeans, the name of where they were from. They were one and the same. In Israel, they had a different name. In Israel, people called them Magi. Wise men or kings, it doesn't quite capture the meaning of this word, Magi. Magi were people who could do otherwise impossible things because they had access to hidden, secret knowledge. In other places, in other contexts, the word Magi could mean wizard or sorcerer. But Magi, they were people who could do things that would be impossible for others because of their access to hidden knowledge. Their tools, the tools of the Magi, they were astronomical observation, specialized coding and decoding, abstract theoretical mathematics. That is how the world's foremost experts in astronomy, came to walk into Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we have observed his star and its rising, and we have come to pay him homage." No word had been sent to them. King Herod did not even know of it himself. No word had been sent to them. They had learned of it by looking at the stars. They saw something in the stars that others could not see, or seeing could not understand. Perhaps Mercury and Venus were both simultaneously in retrograde, or perhaps Marduk and Ishtar had emerged and stood still while in the house of Nergal knows. But what is certain is that the gospel story unfolds as if it is quite obvious that the birth of Jesus should, in fact, be accompanied by strange appearances in the sky. It is only natural to the gospel author. In fact, they are not troubled in the least. The Gospel of Matthew is not troubled in the least that non-Jewish people from distant lands should be able to discern what God was doing in the world simply by looking at the natural world and understanding the movements of the stars. It's only natural, it seems, that these magi, these experts in hidden knowledge gleaned from the stars, it's only natural that they should understand what God is doing in the world. Now, whatever we modern people might think of astrology or divination or omens or portents, the point of view revealed in the gospel is that these astronomers from afar, they could in fact understand what God was doing because they could understand the natural world. To understand the natural world at the gears of it, at the heart of it, at the law of it, the logic of it. For the Bible, as for Christians in ancient times, there was not a distinction between what God was doing and what was going on in the natural world. These were not distinct. It was a two-way street. God had created the natural world, and so the natural world revealed true things about God. Learning about the natural world then was a legitimate and well-established way to learn about God. It even has a name. It's called natural theology. Now, natural theology is rather old-fashioned and unpopular these days, but it is nevertheless well-attested, even in the Bible itself. The Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Romans, perhaps the most important theological treatise of the Christian scriptures, Paul logically grounds his opening argument in the idea that people, all people, are capable of knowing God simply from examining the world around them. Romans 1. For what can be known about God is plain, because God has shown it to us. Ever since the creation of the world, God's eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the world God has made. It's not simply in the Christian scriptures either. It's there as plain as day in Psalm 19, which we read earlier today. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the dome of the stars proclaims God's handiwork. Day to day, they pour forth speech, and night to night, they declare knowledge of God. In the witness of Scripture and for the vast majority of Christian history, probing scientific understanding and a deep faith, these things have gone hand in hand. To know and understand the world deeply, at the gears of it, at the heart of it, the logic of it, the law of it, this is to know and understand something true of the divine. The Magi show us this. And some of the brightest lights of scientific inquiry in all of human history, they show us this too. Some of the brightest lights of scientific inquiry have been either theologians in their own right as well, or at the minimum, deeply faithful, pious people. There's Francis Bacon, Francis Bacon, who pioneered the modern scientific method and also published numerous works of theology and made his own translations of the Psalms. Or there was Blaise Pascal, an influential mathematician and a Christian apologist, influential enough that one of his ideas even has a kind of a shorthand attached to it. It's called Pascal's Wager, his most famous argument. There was Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz, both men independently developing differential calculus, both independently deeply pious men. Antoine Lavoisier, the father of modern chemistry, Gregor Mendel, the father of taxonomy, James Maxwell, who first formulated the laws of electromagnetism, Hildegard of Bingen, the mother of German medicinal botany, Virginia Apgar, the mother of modern obstetrics, all of these people were enormously important scientists and also deeply faithful people. There is no contradiction. There need not be one. There is no necessary contradiction between a life of faith and a life of hunger for understanding the truth of the natural world. To peer beyond. To peer beyond the basic appearances of nature, to seek after the laws that govern, to spend an entire life devoted to the search for what is true, devoted to the idea that there is something true to be found, something worthy to be found in the natural world. This is, in its own way, a search for the very face of God. The world, I think, needs new natural theologies. New natural theologies, ones that are capable of wrestling with and marveling in the beauty and the wonder of the world that we live in, far more wonderful than we have ever known. Each generation, we inherit a world far more wondrous than the one that we were born into, because of this quest of scientific understanding. We need new scientific and natural theologies, ones that are capable of wrestling with and understanding dark matter and dark energy, ones that might hearken back to the creation story itself, when God separated the light from the darkness and declared the whole of it good. Or we might need new natural theologies around artificial intelligence, kinds that look on the stories of the Hebrew Bible with new eyes, ones that look to those stories not merely as guidance for how we as children of God ought to live in relationship to the one who has created us, but rather also searching for fresh meaning as we begin to birth a kind of life that has never been before. We need new readings, fresh sympathy and love for God, the Creator. And we must not be surprised. We must not be surprised when we, like the Magi visiting from afar, when we see unbelievable news, fresh revelations breaking from God, arriving from the most unlikely quarters, brought by the most unlikely messengers, things that might leave us and all around quaking with fear at what this means for the world and how we believed that it worked, finding it to be more amazing than we had ever known, upsetting all that had been, portending good news. We must return to the witness of the Christian faith, to the witness of Scripture, to the truth that lies within our tradition, that scientific inquiry and a deep life of faith, these things are both holy quests, both seeking, straining after the face of God, and that blessing one another, we might be a blessing to all God's world.